Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Nicolas de Cusa, a 15th century German super thinker who extracted the last breaths from the ancient logic. He was a Neoplatonist, so he looked at Plato, and Plato had a theory of God which he melded into the theory of Christian realism theory, and actually came up with an idea that eventually that mathematics was the ultimate form of godliness. There you go. Lots of interesting things. This is episode 9 of this, where I just read out the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And I'm reading in sections just to improve my cardiac rehabilitations, because you get your brain gets mucked around a bit, so this helps me get to it. This is section 4, so this is the last sections, and we go into a different area here. Contribution to political ideas. Nicolas of Cusa has attracted frequent notice in the history of political ideas because of his early work, the Catholic Concordance, the Concordatio Catholica, from 1433 to 34. This lengthy work in three books is aimed first of all at the ecclesiastical audience of the Council of Basel, and only secondarily in book 3 at the Holy Roman Empire and its electors, the Emperor. Nicholas' ideas stand squarely with the conciliarist tradition, following the proposal from the Council of Constance, 1414 to 1418, and thus privileged the Council's authority above the Pope's. In Book 1, he expounds a hierarchical view of creation of the Church following the Dionysian and Applegate, Areopagite. Then he uses both canon law and historical documents from and about the early church councils to undergird his view of the council and the papacy. Yet he never denies the importance of the positions of pope and emperor. Throughout, Nicholas works to harmonize concordantia, the many different strands of church law and political theory. Over the last century, scholars of political history have singled out chapters, particularly in Book 2, where Nicholas discusses consent as prerequisite for legitimate law and government. And I have to say, even contracts and administration myself, I think if I have to analyse a lot of the failed state situations that I'm up against at the moment, there's the idea that you can actually do things without consent. It's quite amazing, and then get people to cooperate at the end of it. It's a sort of strange view. Going beyond the tradition of canon law, he argues on the basis of people's natural freedom. Men are by nature equal in power and equally free, and all governance comes from consent of the subjects. This argument, too, explicitly institutionalizes consent is Nicholas's original contribution, i.e. that's a beautiful idea, isn't it? He follows it with proposals on representation that move from representation as virtual impersonalization to representation as a delegation based on those represented selecting their representatives. This is one of the first explicit statements in the West of the institutional limits to be placed on rulers and the idea that people must consent to their representative institutions. So this is pretty big stuff. Even after he changed allegiance to the side of the papal supremacy, Nicholas used his ideas to argue later brief writings that Basel was not truly representative and that consent was not embodied in the College of Cardinals. In the following centuries, secular parliaments returned to the ideas of consent and representation, though not directly to Nicholas's book in attempting to restrict the power of monarchs. In the Church itself, tradition continued to outweigh innovation. The idea of consular superiority to the Pope seemed dead for centuries. Some of the 20th century's thinking in the Roman Catholic Church has returned to and enlivened the ideas about the Council and the papacy propounded by Nicolas de Cusa. Yeah, so this is the fundamental idea. It's people sort of focus on the vote and the right and stuff like that. It's whether people consent as a whole, consent to what's going on. This is very interesting. Just a few other strands. I can't quite remember where I read it. There's other contradictory things in Nicholas Goose's life in that he, I think, was for imprisoning heretics and sentencing various people to death. I mean, everyone did it back in those days, but it is interesting that he is sort of limited by his understanding, deep understanding of Platonic logic and philosophy. And it seems deep to us, but I mean, that's all that was there back then, whereas people here would look at Boolean logic and look at the names of Kant. There's other ones that are Russell. Look at those. Those weren't there. So he's quite. So what I'm saying is that he is very deep and well learned, but there's only a limited amount of things to be learned about. But his fundamental ideas really expounded the last little bits of philosophy left. And I would say that my interpretation of, like, a lot of the Roman philosophers, like Seneca, were apologists to their paying masters. And I think eventually he was, but this is Nicholas. However, a lot of the philosophical lines that were being developed in ancient Greece and ancient philosophy didn't proceed in the political framework because they were inconvenient to the political setup at the time, a very warlike setup, like the Roman Empire was basically a warring state. I don't know if you can hear a steam train. Steam train going down the canyon just outside my house. And look, there's heaps of very tame birds. I don't know why they're tame. I don't feed them or anything like that, but they come up and sit on your chair and all this type of stuff. Thanks for listening. This is the end of episode 9, a tour of Nicholas de Casa, someone who you say, when you look at the various people, they come up with the original idea, but they refer originally to the work that he was doing. So he's obviously an embodiment of the ideas, the precept of ideas of why you have people contemplating God also contemplate mathematics. It seems a universal theme. So you have Pythagoras and mathematics, the Platonic solids, and the interest in mathematics as a form of philosophical inquiry. It's only now that we've actually separated this all out into different streams. So you've got theologians, philosophers, and mathematicians back then. It was all fused into one, and in terms of transdisciplinary studies, they were all across the various disciplines and could think in parallel or in metaphor. And the other interesting thing about him is his use of metaphor, realizing that it's imperfect, but can actually use the imperfection of metaphors that he has to infer the limitations of thought. So this is sort of very base level philosophy going forward. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.